So we're back for the final installment of our five-part series entitled Money Changers, in which we're talking with Benjamin Zoba, who is a local organic farmer and community activist in his hometown. We've explored the whole landscape of what's involved in the current money system, such as we know it. The first part, we explored the idea of rethinking generally how we do money, highlighting the kind of negative effects that the current money system, such as it's configured, has had. The second part of our five-part series focused on the role of the Federal Reserve Bank, which came into existence in 1913 under circumstances that were less than transparent. And Ben helped us understand how this new entity, in turn, has been controlling the markets, particularly by creating scarcity, which has had a snowballing effect in terms of people's lives, psychological impact it has on how we think about money, how we think about our neighbors, how we think about community, and also the crippling effects that their control has had on the economy generally because of the element of usury driven by exploitation, undue, onerous interest rates that go into the pockets of people as opposed to back into the community. So we're dealing with a system that is predatory and onerous and is really taking a toll on everyday people. From there, we then, in part four, explored some possible workable, viable alternatives and has set up as good examples for how we can rethink how we do our money. He mentioned the Vier banking system in Switzerland. He mentioned the work of Ellen Brown in her book, Web of Debt. The work of Thomas Greco in his book, The End of Money and the Future of Civilization. He mentioned Anthony Michals and his successful model of the talent system, which is a mutual credit exchange. And at one point, he even highlighted the state of North Dakota, which has its own money system operated at the state level successfully. So all of this has been our mutual aspiration to create a new conversation about this, to open some new possibilities of how we look at money, and to a larger cultural conversation about it. So today, as we undertake part five, Ben is going to be answering questions that listeners have put to me or him throughout this process, and we'll wrap it up with that. All right, well, going to the questions then, one listener has asked the question, what is your earliest memory of using money?
I think at least the one that is coming to mind, the earliest memory I have of money was when my grandfather played this game with us as kids where he would hold a $1 bill and we would put our fingers about an inch apart, our index and thumb, around where the Washington's head would be on the $1 bill. And he would drop it and we were supposed to react and try to catch it after he'd drop it. You know, if you pinch your fingers too early, cheating or whatever, so you gotta wait to respond till when he drops it, and it's so hard to do. That was my earliest memory, which is kind of, actually, it's interesting to think about, because money really is a game in a lot of ways. It's a system of recording points, and different games can have different objectives. In our current game, it seems like the objective is get as much as you can for yourself, but other games, like, you know, if you're with a good group of people playing frisbee, for example, and they all just are happy to be together, running around, getting exercise, loving each other. That's a game that isn't like a zero-sum kind of a situation. Everyone can win. So we can make a money system that is a game that's more fun for everyone.
Okay, well, in keeping with the spirit of this listener's question, let me ask you this. Apart from the game that you played with your grandfather with the dollar bill, was there a sensibility that you remember being instilled with growing up from your family? How did the money orientation show itself?
Well, I remember when I was 8, we decided as a family to move to Honduras, and we had a big yard sale, sold a bunch of stuff. We were living in New Jersey at that time, and you know, I kept track of everything that I sold of mine, a keyboard and, you know, just stuffed animals and all this stuff. And it added up to a lot of dollars for a little kid. I remember kind of getting that twinkle in my eye where I might rub my hands together and imagine all the things I might do with my great wealth. And then we went to Honduras and that dollar was worth a lot there. I could get a lot of Ninja Turtles action figures and firecrackers when the season came around. So I definitely remember the lure of money and actually the power of the dollar compared to currencies that are subservient to the dollar.
Okay, well, you learned early how to play the game. Another question that's come up is one that I also am interested to hear a little bit more about is over the course of these conversations, you have mentioned on more than one occasion this false doctrine of liberty. Could you help us understand a little bit more what you're saying when you say the false doctrine of liberty? Because liberty is kind of at the fulcrum of who we are as a people. So I don't think just by saying that, people understand what you're trying to get at.
Well, I think this is real important to talk about because we mentioned at the very beginning of this, it's the choices, it's the decisions of individuals that have eternal and lasting import. And so what I meant by true and false liberty is Jesus taught us that joy and freedom comes in love and truth, service. So he says, he who would be greatest in the kingdom of heaven, in the family of heaven, would be a server of all. So he's revealing to us, he's showing us that in God's eternal universe, if you want to become greater, you have to get better and better at serving people. We get to get better and better at serving people. That's where freedom comes. It comes with equal parts responsibility and self-control. If you had unlimited freedom without self-control, you can destroy yourself by moving too quickly and by detaching yourself from God's pattern. Maybe an analogy could be, if you think of a tree, if one branch on a tree thought to itself, oh, well, here we all are getting light from the sun, but I want to get more light than the rest of my branches. I'll stretch myself farther and farther. I'll take more and more energy. I'll take the role of the vine. I will choose where resources go, and I'll choose they go to me and those who follow me. And you envision this branch reaching for the sun, maybe short-term growth. It gets more light than other branches, and it seems, oh, wow, it's growing. Branch is right. They're just taking, and it's working. But once that branch continues in behaving in a way that's not in line with the vine, who supports all branches so that the whole vine grows, maybe more slowly, but it produces more fruit over time, that branch, if it cuts itself off from that, it'll overextend, it'll snap, it'll break off, and a branch cut off is dead. It's not living. There's no fruit. Lucifer himself basically did that. You know, he said, by my own decision, I'm going to do my own thing. And he tried to get Jesus to do that too when Jesus met him in the wilderness. He said, bow before me. All these cities are yours. Boom. Just like that. Instant. You could have a quick, short-term growth. But Jesus replied saying he was beholden to do the Father's will, which is slower, but more fruitful and good for all. So I kind of see this, it can be this one branch, this, you know, banking cartel that's, you know, maybe it's getting the churches to build a nest in its branches, even though it's about to collapse. Or maybe it's inspiring other branches to try to betray the vine itself and do their own thing. But the remedy is Jesus's gospel message that by bearing fruit, by enjoying fully the energy coming from the vine, by loving the energy and the love we get from God, and then by letting that just go through us outward to others. And it's going to make a bigger tree that can have more and more branches and more fruit.
Okay, so then essentially, am I correct in understanding what you're saying, that this false doctrine of liberty is this overemphasis on the short term and overemphasis on self-interest over against the restraint needed, the discipline needed, the hopefulness needed to act in a way that is more focused on the larger community, the larger whole, and the health of the larger system?
Yeah.
So, in other words, individual people, when they're appropriating this doctrine of false liberty, that's what they're appropriating. You can have it all right now. So it robs them of the eternal purview, and it also robs them of the communal aspect of what it means to be human, and particularly to be a member of the kingdom of God. Is that what you're saying?
Yep, and it robs them of liberty. That's why I call it false liberty. Greater is he who conquers himself than captures a city. You can get all the wealth in the world, but if you're still in bondage to your own selfishness, you are not free. And Jesus came to free us from that bondage, not by sacrifice or by necessarily, you know, punishing ourselves or being poor. He freed us from our selfishness by inviting us into the wonder and the joy of other-mindedness, of serving the whole vine and all the branches. And that is the liberating message that Jesus offers us, that we can, by one decision of faith, can immediately access true freedom. And that's something that the banking system can't offer.
What's that one decision? When you say that one decision of faith can bring us freedom.
It is my will that your will be done. I choose your way. Part of this false doctrine is that one part can grow faster than the whole. It manifests itself in all kinds of different ways. The Jewish rulers in Jesus' time thought Israel could rule at the expense of other people. Jesus, with his parable of the Good Samaritan, so beautifully and clearly pointed out that the family of God is each individual who's choosing to be like God, choosing to love people like God loves people.
Okay. And then one listener asked a question about Iceland, interestingly. He wanted to know if you've done any research or exploration about the economic model in Iceland. I'm curious to know why he would ask that and what your response is.
Yeah, well, back in 2008, basically when all these banks and this system failed by creating a huge bubble that was inevitably going to burst, in the U.S., we had our quote-unquote representatives who, first they rejected the bailout, but then one of the first things when Obama was in office that ended up happening, it was the government agreed to pay for the bank's mistakes with the people's money. They said, okay, you guys screwed up. You were selfish and unwise. So Iceland took the opposite approach. Iceland had some banks too that owed a lot to foreign investors, and the IMF and, you know, these international banking elites were putting pressure on Iceland to do the same thing, to bail out the banks with the people's money, basically steal from the people and give it to the banks. And the people of Iceland wouldn't have it, and Iceland did the opposite. They said the people are going to get taken care of first in this economic crisis. We're going to make sure that the average person, family person, the homeowner can take care of his or her mortgage. And once we get our economic system humming, the banks can get what's left over. I remember hearing Bill Still talk about how the IMF, like, you know, threatened this island economy would be without food within a few weeks or something. But they were courageous, you know, the people whose ancestors were the Vikings said no. And sure enough, the predictions by the IMF that they would fail were wrong. And as far as I know, Iceland did just fine, and they showed the world that you don't have to succumb to this fear-mongering by the banks and by the governments and by the media owned by the banks that tries to make people think the world will collapse without these financial wizards. There are plenty of people who know how to do it better, and it would be a good thing if this usury cartel failed, and it will fail eventually. But Iceland just showed that by activating the political will of the people, they can take back sovereignty over their country.
Do you see how that might play out in the context of this country? And if so, how do you see that the same kind of revolt could manifest itself?
I bet in Iceland, you know, it's a much smaller population. They have the island mentality already, which kind of makes you think more independently. But here we will have to deal with these things eventually, whether it's before some kind of major crash or after. And the issue of usury is one that we will have to protect ourselves against. You know, we could make an amendment to protect ourselves from it. Make laws that the government cannot borrow. That would be one simple law. Governments can't borrow. They can create their own, but they can't borrow. Another simple one is banks can't lend money they don't have. Individuals can't counterfeit money, so neither can private banks. Those are two basic rules that we could easily make. But it seems like the problem that we have right now is Old Testament says the borrower is servant to the lender. And as we've talked about in these podcasts, the government borrows from private banks. So our representatives, quote unquote, are servants to the banks, and at least, you know, at the federal level. I think there's more hope at the state and municipal levels. Fixing the banking system, rooting out the corruption in the government. These are our tasks. We have to do them, you know, for our kids or our grandkids. So it's our duty and it's our opportunity to get real experience here on this rebellion-torn planet. But really, the root of it is what we've talked about earlier. You know, if we help people catch the vision that Jesus, the creator, who knows about the economy, the spiritual economy of the universe, he came here and he showed us and he told us about heaven and the Father. And I was thinking about how beautifully he showed it. I mean, he was so powerful. This false doctrine of liberty says get power by taking it. Whereas Jesus had power. He, you know, he was the creator. And he could have had legions of angels just and annihilate his enemies. But he just kept with the Father's way of steady growth, where he didn't annihilate his enemies. He even allowed the natural course to lead to his death. You know, he didn't intervene. He allowed his blood to run out and his lungs to run out of oxygen, all the while having power and steadfastly refusing to use it for self-aggrandizement. And by that, he has appealed to millions, billions of people throughout the generation. And even though we might be oppressed economically, you know, under this system, we are free. We can serve as children of God joyfully. We can bear these burdens. We can fix the problems. We don't want our religion to be an opiate. It just makes us tolerate this stuff. Jesus took strong stands against economic exploitation when he cleansed the temple. Even though they might rule our banking system, they have no grasp on our soul. They cannot stifle our soul growth one bit. In fact, the trials that they're putting before us actually give us great opportunity to grow our souls. The kingdom of heaven that Jesus told us about is such a vibrant, attractive, living, dynamic reality that if people saw the kingdom, the family of God, people really with full integrity and wisdom, living for the benefit of the whole, living for the benefit of all people on the planet, and working intelligently to really care for all people on the planet, or all people in the community, whatever sphere of influence you have, then people will be drawn to that. I kind of think about the church in relation to the money system. If people are looking for something that's real and something that's different, kind of the status quo of our culture right now is like this kind of secularism, materialism that's boring, ugly, involves war, which is so outdated. It's like, why the heck are we bombing people all the time to try to get them to do what we want or not? It's like people want something that's different. And if the church is just more of the same, then nobody's going to be attracted to it. If the church is just like not questioning this banking system, fully reliant on this banking system, working with it, making money off of it, not questioning it, people aren't going to see anything new there. And it's like, why the heck would we join that? But the church has a real opportunity with this stuff. If it really got its act together and just like Jesus cleansed the temple, it could draw the loyalty of, you know, young, courageous, enthusiastic people who want to actually do something, make a difference in the world. And I would imagine it might not look the same as, you know, coming in and singing some hymns in a derelict building, but the church could thrive if it really tries to live with full integrity. You cannot serve God and mammon. If there's any element of mammon serving, cut it out, you know, stop it, fix it. You know, if you want people who are interested in real spirit things, then you got to get real.
What would be an example of a mammon aspect of the church that need to be cut out?
Even just questioning this system behind the pulpit. Even I am trying to figure out how to communicate these things tactfully to good people who have invested their lives in this system. Again, our life here is so short compared to our eternal career. And eventually we're going to have to decide, who are we loyal to? Are we loyal to the master? And will we go wherever he wants us? It'll be for our benefit if we do, but it can be scary. Might have to take a pay cut. You might get fired. You might go to jail. You might die. But this is the stuff that the young people are ready for, you know? It's like people are signing up to join the Marines. They can't even hire everyone that wants to join that because young people want to do something. And if we can give them something that's positive and constructive and thrilling, dangerous, then let's do it and let's make the world better for everyone.
Well, it's been a very interesting conversation, a very interesting journey into a kind of a dark underbelly of the way we live. And I hope that our listeners take from this a sense that there is a better way to share our resources, to develop ourselves as part of humanity. And really, I'm grateful, Ben, for all the work you've done and for your sincerity and your passion for this. And I hope it bears fruit.
It's been fun, and I look forward to meeting people who are listening to this, either on this life or throughout the eternal adventure.
All right, well, thanks a lot. It's been very fascinating, and we might be hearing more from Ben at a future date about his ongoing work in this way. This is Poets and Lunatics. Thanks for listening.